This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. There's a chance to find out a little bit of Lake County history if you go online, checking out a Facebook page and a YouTube channel. It's all about a project that is known as History Alive TV, and we have with us the fellow who's created all that and the series of documentaries that are out there, in particular the one that's out about the old Lake County Jail. Darren Zancan is with us to talk about it. Darren, thank you for joining us on the program.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Tell us a little bit first about the ideas that put together the History Alive TV channels and where, in particular, the latest episode that's out there for you to see online about the old Lake County Jail came about.
Yeah, so I was in grad school at Northwestern in 2012, and one of my documentary projects was to just do a short documentary on something newsworthy of choice. And since I grew up in Lake Dale, just, you know, 8 minutes from the jail, mm-hmm. I knew the history of John Dillinger. I knew a little bit about the jail. And so I reached out to the historians at the jail. I said, hey, can I come do this project for school? And at the time, they weren't really allowing people to come in and film, but I think I twisted their arm good enough to let me come in. And so I just did a short project for work on John Dillinger and kind of, you know, his story a little bit. And this was right around the time of Public Enemy, so it was a really good time to do it. And then they had said, hey, did you know this place is allegedly haunted? And I'm like a journalist by trade. I'm not, I don't know, you know, do I believe in ghosts or not? It's one of those things where it was more intriguing to learn, not necessarily like I believe that a ghost is going to like throw me down the stairs or something like that. So I was like, sure, I'll come do a paranormal investigation. And so I went with them and we did that, and at one point I said, you know, it'd be really cool in the future to do some type of historical paranormal show. And that was in 2012 that I said that. And then around 2018, my company, DMZ Productions, started kind of growing. And when I hired somebody full time, we were looking at the old footage that I'd filmed very amateur during the paranormal investigation. And I stopped what we were doing. I said, you know what? We're going to do the show. We're just going to do it right now. You know, looking at this footage is kind of inspiring me to do it. And so we dropped everything we were doing in that moment and kind of started focusing on History Alive. And the cool thing that a lot of people don't know about is Grant Wilson, who is, Mr. Ghost Hunter, who started the TV show Ghost Hunters. He was living about 10 minutes from me in Richmond, Kentucky at the time. And we reached out to him, and he kind of helped us, you know, navigate and build and kind of plan the beginning of all of this. He gave us ideas, and then from there we started filming and building, and now we're here last night being the History Alive premiere of The Imprisoned, is what the episode's called, uh-huh. At the Lake County Jail.
Tell us about some of the other places that you've done so far, at least, and are planning at least to do, are dealing with paranormal investigations.
So, yeah, so we started at Waveland State Historic Site. It's in Lexington, Kentucky. And then we transitioned to the second episode to Whitehall. Whitehall is where Cassius Clay, the original Cassius Clay, his family and estate was, and that's here in Richmond, Kentucky. Obviously, the jail. Old Lake County Jail in Crown Point, Indiana. Then we have, we've been in talks, and we're getting ready to, before COVID, obviously, we're planning to go to Rugby, Tennessee. That is, a lot of people claim it's the most haunted small town in America, about 2.5 hours south of us. We've been down there. We've kind of got a lay of the land. We've also filmed segments at the Perryville Battlefield, which is one of the bloodiest battles in Civil War history. And then when we travel for other projects, we'll reach out to historical sites and you know, we'll let them know what we're doing. And it seems like because our pitch is pretty strong and because we're based off history, this isn't a 100% a paranormal show. This is a very strong blend of, you know, we look at history first. We research and we talk to historians and we learn about the artifacts and we learn about the people that either lived at this house or who were a part of this, you know, facility, this being a jail, there was obviously inmates, but if you go to a historical house, it's family, And so there's a place called Belvoir Winery, which is Liberty, Missouri, that used to be a children's orphanage and a hospital. So we've been out there, and we've filmed some there. We've been out to Salem, Massachusetts, and we filmed stuff at, you know, where the Salem Witch Trials have been. So we've kind of been all over the country, kind of filming pieces here and there. But, you know, right now we've got three episodes done, a fourth one almost finished, and then rugby is on the horizon, you know. If COVID wouldn't have happened, we probably would have had that episode too.
Okay. Well, let's get back to the old Lake County Jail and the research that you all had done. You, of course, had personal research because of having lived here in Northwest Indiana. But what did you find out about some of the people, the inmates who inhabited the old jail, probably just as notorious as the one that everybody knows about, and that is bank robber John Dillinger?
Yes, the thing is, everybody kind of sits on that. You know, oh, it's John Dillinger. He's obviously a very big name, and his name has even grown because of Johnny Depp and Public Enemies. But the thing is, he stayed there for a very short time. It wasn't like he was there for 10, 15 years where some of these other people have been there for months and years. He was there for a very small moment in history, but because his name value is so strong, people just think it's synonymous with the jail. But there was all these people that these notorious, killers and just bad people, evil people that were there for a long time. And so learning about them, that was the focus, really. This whole show, there was maybe 2 to 3 minutes tops about John Dillinger. And then we focused really on these cast of criminals. You know, there's times that there were 500 people in that jail over several years. So if you think of how many thousands of people have come and gone, common felons, you know, things, people that were just doing common, like, robberies, you know, things that weren't horrific. And then there were really horrific moments like rape and, like, burying people alive and all these other, you know, really hellacious and heinous criminal activity. So it was a blend of all of these people, and we really got to learn a lot of history about these names that, you know, you don't hear about because John Dillinger kind of takes front and center.
Right. How much research did you have to do in getting prepared, especially for the old Lake County Jail episode?
Hours. I mean, hours and hours. We have historians. You know, we worked with Sandy Boyd, who's the president of the jail. You know, we worked with her. I sat down with her several days, and we went through archives and articles and every piece of historical information, obviously researching online, to our host of the show, Jeffrey. He is a historian, so he is researching. We don't turn our camera on until we know everything that we can possibly know about the time periods, the people who were there, because to us, it's very important that we make sure that we get history right. And there's a lot of people that are huge history fans, and if you get one thing wrong, they're gonna call you out on it because it's inaccurate, even from the way outfits were worn during certain periods. So we spend hours and hours and hours because we want to make sure it's right and that it's accurate and that it's all put together the right way.
Did you have the opportunity in putting all this together for the presentation that's on the Facebook page and on the YouTube channel to be able, as you mentioned, about the research that you had to do, and of course making sure that the outfits and the costumes are right? Did you get to do many reenactments to go along with the storyline?
Yeah, that's always the fun part, because when it comes to the history, we reenact a few things. So we always reenact the history because it's important, again, to show people these moments in time. So the Raymond Carrs and the Ann Cunninghams and all of these people that are there, you know, we learn these stories so we get the stories accurate, and then we reenact a lot of these moments. There was a couple people that tried to hang themselves in the jail, so there were segments with, you know, you see a noose and they're about to hang themselves. I mean, there's a lot of that in there. And then we also had reenactments with people who, I always say allegedly because you don't, you know, it's everybody's take on something, but allegedly witnessed or saw something. So we would bring them in and kind of rewalk through their moments. And then you take all that put it all together, and then you have a paranormal investigation. So it's all of these pieces. And then we have narration, which, you know, makes it, I think, a lot different than a lot of these other paranormal shows, because it is rooted in history, but then we have a narrator along with tons and tons of interviews that are guiding people through this period of time.
Now, I know that you have it on the Facebook and on the YouTube channel, but are you hoping that maybe that this series, History Alive and ones in the future, will end up on some streaming service?
Yeah, that's our goal. I mean, great thing is we have, we're working on this project. We have another a comedy series called The Home. It's about life in a nursing home. I worked at a nursing home in Indiana for a while, and all these stories I kind of started writing down. And so we're creating two totally different shows. And so our goal is to really have a really strong portfolio and with the people involved to get it. I love right now this time in TV history, because I always tell people, if we were doing History Live in the Home 10 years ago, you had cable. That was it. It was cable, and Netflix was still just kind of like a red box where you could watch a movie. Now you have all of these options for people to watch wherever they want to watch. And so I'm really excited, because I think we have such a unique opportunity to get what we're working on in front of a lot of eyes. And so that is our end goal, is to get it to the best possible place so that people can really experience, what we're doing.
Darren Zancan is owner of DMZ Productions. He's a Northwest Indiana native from Lake County, as a matter of fact. He's put out, among other things, a series which is called History Alive, and the latest episode that is out there to see on Facebook and on YouTube, and the YouTube channel, is about the old Lake County Jail. Darren, thank you very much for telling us about not only your company, about the history and the research that you did in putting out the latest episode about the old Lake County Jail, and good luck on the others coming up.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Researchers at Purdue University are working to find more environmentally friendly adhesives for everything from cardboard packages to shoes. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ben Thorpe tells us that they're hoping that creatures like shellfish might hold some clues for trying to get things to stick together naturally.
Purdue researchers say many adhesives are petroleum-based, making them difficult to recycle. Professor Jonathan Wilker points to cardboard boxes around his office, many of them with white packaging labels stuck to their sides.
No one's going to bother to pull the stuff off before it goes in the recycling bin. And even if you tried, you wouldn't be able to get it all off. So this box is destined for the landfill.
In an effort to find more sustainable, environmentally friendly alternatives, Wilker is looking at marine creatures like shellfish, which use their own natural adhesives to stick to surfaces.
And then, because they're bio-based and sustainably sourced, the adhesives could potentially degrade later. So sustainability is an area that we're putting a lot of effort into these days.
Wilker says one of the bioadhesives developed by his team could reach the commercial market as early as this year. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Ben Thorpe.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. The rise of sundown towns came after Black Americans, no longer confined to one county by slavery, began to venture into other areas. White communities throughout the North began putting up signs warning Black people to stay out of their towns after sundown, often with the threat of violence or even death. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Ella Abbott reports on how the impact of those towns continues to affect communities and how it all ties into the civil unrest that we see today.
Sundown towns are towns that were, for decades, all white on purpose, and some of them still are.
James Lowen is a sociologist and historian who authored the book Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. He keeps up a website where he continues to research and confirm suspected sundown towns with help from readers and residents in these towns. Why is it so important to chronicle this part of a town's history? Lowen mentions Ferguson, Missouri as an example of what he calls second-generation sundown town problems. Ferguson was briefly a sundown town between 1940 and 1960. Lowen says the Black population was thrown out by the white population. He says the separation was enforced by an overwhelmingly white police force, which would ticket and harass Black motorists for passing through the town.
Well, by the time Ferguson had the shall we say, riot or demonstrations, for which they are now famous, Ferguson was almost two-thirds Black, but it still had that leftover from the sundown town day police force. So that's an example of a second-generation sundown town problem.
Jacoby Williams is a professor of African American and African Diaspora Studies at Indiana University and specializes in social justice, politics, and civil rights. He explains the relationship policing had to sundown towns during their heyday and how it relates to the distrust of policing we're seeing today.
So, for example, if a person, and this is anecdotal, but these are real-life experiences, a person of color is in a particular location that's classified as a sundown town, and the people of that community attack that person, the police will not arrest them. In fact, they may arrest the person who was attacked.
Today, Williams says this translates as law enforcement who may harass people of color for being in areas they don't think they belong in by following them out of town, searching them without proper explanation, or giving them tickets. He says the civil rights movement in the 1960s and the Black Lives Matter movement we're seeing today are mirror images of each other as they continue to fight for many of the same issues.
The difference between the two periods now is folks are calling for defunding the police, whereas in the earlier generations in the 60s, for example, and beyond, folks were advocating for community control of policing. So defunding the police and community control is still similar, whereas defunding the police is asking that those resources be allocated to certain entities in the community so the community can police themselves. And in the 60s, having community control of police was the same, having people who are from the community do most of the policing themselves to avoid these confrontations.
Lowen also says that the ongoing legacy of these towns is often misunderstood and damaging. He uses Kenilworth, Illinois, as an example. Lowen says Kenilworth is the richest suburb of Chicago, which 5 years ago didn't have a single black household. After hearing time and again that Kenilworth is just too expensive for black families, Lowen decided to do his own research.
And I found that there are 7,000 black households, black families, in the Chicago area that make more money than the median family does in Kenilworth. So they could not only move into Kenilworth in terms of economics, they could move into the upper half of Kenilworth, into the larger houses. But they don't.
Still, the explanation of just not rich enough not only persists, but is then passed down to younger generations to continue to sow the belief that people of color are economically inferior.
So we have to realize that we're not talking about racism in the distant past. We're talking about racism in a fairly recent past that still affects the fortunes of black folks and white folks today.
As protests took place across the nation at the beginning of the summer, Huntington, Indiana was not immune, even as a mostly white community and former sundown town. Mayor Richard Strick says they saw what was happening in other communities and were able to plan out a response to the protest. He says Huntington's law enforcement community recognized that people coming out to protest had a just cause and are passionate about justice.
We wanted to make sure that we supported them as they exercised their constitutional rights and freedoms and helped them to do so in a way that kept them safe and kept the community at large safe as well, also knowing that there was likely to be, and there was, counter-protesters.
Strick says they were able to set law enforcement up in designated areas, intentionally dressed in casual clothing to make them more approachable to encourage dialogue. Their sheriff and chief of police were able to reach out to organizers and help plan things, as well as supply water. Strick says he believes the protest was a sign of progress for the city because of the number of people who showed up, but also that it means there's still a lot of work to be done. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Ella Abbott.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.